Daniel Chacon, your latest book, Hotel Juarez, is your fourth book. You've only written one novel and three books of short stories. Do you prefer stories to novels?
I think so. I think I used to prefer novels to stories when I first started out writing, and I thought I was going to be a novelist. But I guess there's been a shift in my reading preferences, and I find myself reading more poetry than anything else. And poems, even if they're long, tend to be short. And then also, you know, I really admire short fiction, and the short fiction writers have been a great influence on me, everywhere from Flannery O'Connor to Bernard Malamud to Truett Anderson. You know, so I really admire short fiction. And I think, you know, I think I've come to a point in my, I don't know what word to use, so let's call it development, uh-huh. in my development as a writer, that I'm leaning towards shorter pieces rather than longer pieces. And it's doubtful, I think, that I'll ever write a novel again unless it's maybe a novel told in flash fiction, you know, or a disjunctive novel with, you know, a lot of different images mm-hmm. that create a larger picture. But, you know, something that could be read, the short pieces, and you know, build up on it as we go.
And it strikes me, as I read your book, you have a very different way of telling a story than, say, someone like me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very traditional storyteller.
Right.
You know, when I write a story, it's really a very traditional story. Yours are not traditional story. And I think one of the things that you do that, and you do it really well, is you evoke more than you state. You evoke a world without a lot of description.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go on and on about describing anything. It's very spare. And yet you manage to conjure a place, and you conjure people. But one of the questions I want to ask you about people is that they often don't have names. Many times they do. But then there's the professor, the old woman, you know.
Right.
And you made a choice not to give them names. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'll address both of your comments. The first one about creating a landscape with minimal details, you know, without too much description. And why my characters may not have a name, not that it's a decision that I consciously make when I start a story, but, you know, sometimes I'll finish a story and I'll realize, oh, my character doesn't have a name. One of the things that I try to teach my students is to put the meat in the muscle, you know, and the meat is detail. You know, the meat is imagery. The meat is landscape. The meat is the trees and the roads. And I just was reading a poem today by Naomi Nye. And she was describing a city street at night, and she said the street is a banana, you know. And I really love that because you can see the curve and you can see the light, and you know, and that's all she needed to say to, you know, to flash this image in my head. And I try to teach my students that when you're describing a landscape, you're describing a setting, you're describing a room, to not get out of the story and describe it and describe it and describe it and then jump back in the story, but to make sure that that meaty stuff is muscle as well, and that it pushes the story as you're describing it.
Right.
And so I think that what I try to accomplish in terms of my setting and bringing readers into my house, into my hotel, into my landscape, into whatever, you know, it is I want them to be able to walk into through their imagination, I want every detail to push the story as much as possible
right.
forward. And so I find the best way to do that, and the best writing, or the writing that I admire, is where every detail just kind of pushes on the energy, pushes somewhere, even if it's not plot, it's movement. So yeah, I try to teach that to my students, and, you know, teacher teach thyself. I try to learn from myself as well. The other part is why my characters don't have names. Again, I don't do that consciously. But I think when I write a story, I try to get sometimes as close to the character's consciousness and thought processes. A lot of times when you use the name, it distances you from the character. Rather than being inside the character, you're looking at the character. So if you're constantly, let's say the character's named Kenny, and you're constantly saying, Kenny walked to the refrigerator. Kenny opened it and pulled out a bottle. Every time you say Kenny, you're distancing from Kenny's mind, because Kenny doesn't say that as he's opening the refrigerator.
Right.
And I don't think that when we're in our psyches perceiving the world around us, we say our names. And so I think maybe that's probably why.
Well, I had a theory about that.
Uh-huh.
And that is that because you're writing about a part of the world that people don't understand. And even when you're in Paris, even with the Paris setting, the identity comes with you. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's the section you talk most about identity in a very, you know, specific way, in a very kind of direct way.
Mm-hmm.
That really people think of the people on the border as being nameless.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways.
Right. Absolutely. And I would totally embrace that reading of it. And I would say that reading of it has to be there because I think every choice that we make as writers should have not a locked-in metaphor or parable, but I think it should have metaphorical possibilities. And I love the possibility that nameless characters connects to the namelessness of all the people on the border, all the forgotten people, all the poor and all the hungry and the, quote, immigrants and all that. I love that. I completely embrace that interpretation. Thank you.
Well, no, it's because I really feel that that's one of your minimalist strategies, I thought,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, you're really describing the streets.
Right.
But you do have these certain moments where you feel that you're there,
mm-hmm.
that you feel you're in Juarez, that you feel you're in Paris. But you evoke it, I think, through language. There is a feeling of exile throughout this whole,
mm-hmm.
and traveling, and a lot of walking.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
As if
that you just described my life: exile, traveling, and walking. What I do.
I know that you do all of those things, but you know you don't put it in a book because you do them.
Right.
You do them because they're tools that really get at what you're trying to do, and that is kind of a discovery,
mm-hmm.
and almost even a discovery of. I kind of want to say that you're discovering how to tell a story in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do that. I really don't. I don't think I'm going to try a different way
mm-hmm.
to get across what I want to do and what I want to say. You do it in a way that's in a way more true to life in this sense. Life is fractured and it is fragments
mm-hmm.
and it's not organized in like a linear way. So I thought it was really interesting that you began the book, The Purple Crayon.
The Purple Crayon, right.
And The Purple Crayon is the one chapter that I'm still puzzled over. And I'm not sure why. This is my theory, that it's childlike. And it begins with the baby that talks.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it very intriguing. But why does that story with the baby that talks, and it's essentially about the babysitter, why does it end with the parents making love at the end?
Well, it actually ends with the baby saying another word and the babysitter hearing it. But what the story, it's called Broca's Area.
Right.
And as you know, Broca's Area is the part of the brain where language is developed. And so when children begin to develop in that area, their Broca's Area is very active and expands. And it's an exciting time to watch children create words and say words and come into language. But the story takes place in Kern Place here in El Paso. And the parents of the baby are from Juarez. They're part of the diaspora of the rich, mm-hmm. you know, that people who came over here during the drug wars and bought houses. And so they're Spanish speakers. And the babysitter lives in El Paso's Northeast, which is a diverse neighborhood. And she's African-American and she's monolingual. And so when she hears the baby talk, she doesn't realize that the baby's not going to talk in English. The baby's going to talk in Spanish. But she doesn't know Spanish. So every word that she hears, she kind of has to translate it into English, thinking it's an English word. So like he's, for example, at the end, he says, take care-o. He may very well be saying te quiero, but she has right. to filter it through her own understanding. And so ultimately, I think what the story is about her own desire, you know, her own perceptions of the world, and somehow making these connections between what the baby is muttering and trying to figure it out as if it were a puzzle. But at the root of it, it's this young woman who is, you know, coming into her own ability to feel and to perceive and to desire.
She seems to, not that she doesn't care for him,
mm-hmm.
but she seems to observe him more than she has affection for him.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting, because then you have that, the parents mm-hmm. who are oddly also seem to be distant from the, or absent,
mm-hmm.
well, absent in the story. They might not be absent parents, but right. they're absent in the story, because the story is about
the babysitter.
The babysitter.
Right.
Then you have that moment where they're making passionate love, like what that story, what it evokes for me, what it evoked for me, was this kind of, I kind of asked myself in there, after I read that story, where is love in all of this?
Mm-hmm.
Because it didn't seem, the passionate lovemaking didn't seem like love.
Right, right.
It seemed like lust or something,
right, right.
Or this moment. And yet, in the rest of the book, there is a kind of very understated affection between people
mm-hmm.
and things, books, desires. Was that deliberate, that there's, that it starts off kind of emotionally distant and then it gets more intimate?
I'm not sure. You know, I mean, when I put the stories together, I did like a poet and printed out all the stories and tried to figure out, you know, what order they went into and what order made sense. And I think ultimately, I mean, the first story, I think, at many different drafts were different stories, but I don't remember the ultimate decision as to why I put Broca's area. Mm-hmm. And even if it were an intellectual or rational decision, it might have been more of a gut decision. But I would imagine that the order of things would probably lead us towards a developing consciousness. And so if one were to look at consciousness developing vis-a-vis love, then certainly I think that would be a legitimate reading of that order.
In Me Je Suis Chicano?
Me Je Suis Chicano, uh-huh.
I loved that throughout the whole story, it was so natural that almost every term is in there. Mexican, American, Chicano, Latino. And sometimes there was this thing like, oh, he's a Chicano, but then Mexican, and then American.
Mm-hmm.
And in there, it doesn't seem to be confusion about identity. There just seems to be a kind of embrace of all of those identities.
Mm-hmm.
And some contexts, Mexican is right. Because throughout the book, you know, someone claims to be Mexican, and clearly they're not. I mean, they're not from Mexico.
Uh-huh.
When you were growing up, did you call yourself Mexican?
Yeah.
And when did you start calling yourself a Chicano?
Probably growing up as well. I think we use them interchangeably, you know, Mexican and Chicano. So I think I've always identified as a Mexican. But in that particular story, it's about this Chicano guy who goes to Paris to study painting. And the first thing that he realizes he's encountering discrimination from the French people for two reasons. One, because they think he's Lebanese or Moroccan because
right.
he dresses like a homeboy. And so he's kind of watched as he goes through grocery stores, and cops sometimes frisk him. And, you know, but then when they find out he's American, their disdain for him becomes different. But it's still disdain because he's an American and he's in Paris at a time when anti-American attitudes are at their height. And during the Bush war years. And so he's trying to distance himself from being an American. And so he calls himself a Chicano there. But then when he meets an Arabic woman that he kind of falls in love with, she knows he's an American. She could tell by his accent. And he keeps trying to say, no, I'm a Mexican. I'm a Mexican. I'm a Mexican. Until finally she catches him in the lie as they're wandering through this rooms and rooms of old books. And And she says, I knew it. I knew you were an American.
And you avoid the term Hispanic.
You mean me personally or
no,
in that story?
In that story.
Yeah, well, he identifies himself as a Chicano, and there's very few Chicanos that use the word Hispanic unless they're applying for a grant.
That's funny.
It's true, too.
No, but people use that term.
Right, that character doesn't, but I'm sure there are other characters in the book that would use the term Hispanic.
Right, right. Yeah,
but that particular character, he's a Chicano artist from the barrio. He has those little tattoo crosses. I mean, he's got a very Chicano consciousness and feels very other no matter where he is.
When you go, like, you travel a lot. Mm-hmm. And when you're in Paris or when you're in Buenos Aires, do you feel Latin American? Do you feel Latino? Do you feel Chicano? Or do you feel American?
You know, I think that I feel more American in Mexico than anywhere else. I think when I go to Buenos Aires, they can't always guess where I'm from. And the fact is, Buenos Aires is a humongous city and everybody walks, and I feel very comfortable there. I feel I could be anonymous and at the same time around millions of people. Same with like Paris. Paris is a very comfortable city. It's the kind of city where you can go into and immediately feel comfort. And because I could get by and interact, at least on the street level in French, and because I have darker skin, because I may not necessarily look like an American, I don't get stigmatized there as much as I think somebody with blonde hair and blue eyes and an American accent claiming to be from Canada would get. So I feel very comfortable there. I love cities. I love New York. I can go into New York and be anonymous and be a part of the tumult of humanity at the same time, and I really love that. And I don't feel alienated in a city. In a city, I feel quite at home. I mean, I remember one time I entered into Warsaw at night. My flight arrived like at 1 a.m. and I, you know, had too much energy to sleep. So I walked around Warsaw all night long until like 4 or 5 in the morning, you know, going into different places. And there I really did kind of feel othered, you know, because it was, you know, very clear that I wasn't Polish. But ultimately I don't feel othered anymore, especially living in El Paso, Texas, you know, where if a cop pulls you over for a speeding ticket, the likelihood that he's going to speak Spanish is just as likely as he's going to speak English, you know.
And you use the word alienated.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever your characters are looking for as they walk or as they analyze, they don't feel alienated to me. There's a feeling in your characters that in a sense they belong. The Juarez sections particularly. And even go to the last section.
All right.
The professor, who isn't from Juarez,
mm-hmm.
doesn't feel like it's a foreign place.
Right.
He doesn't feel alienated. He doesn't feel othered. He doesn't feel any of those things.
Yeah,
well, I'm going to go back to that story in a while. But in fact, people have a sense of really belonging.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that there are many types of alienation in, you know, character-based literary fiction. You have the Eugene O'Neill hairy ape syndrome, you know, where a Yank is in the bottom of the ship shoveling coal into the furnace and he's got black all over him. And this young, rich woman comes down, you know, because she wants to see what it's like down there. And she screams when she sees him, and suddenly he has this existential crisis. Who am I? Where do I belong? And I think that's, you know, that's present in a lot of literature. And I think when you look at the Chicano literature, the Chicano literary concept of alienation, it's reinforced with linguistic and cultural alienation, you know.
Right.
But I think the alienation or any kind of sense of not belonging in my characters has less to do with those two types and more to do with maybe feeling alienated in a material reality that their imaginations do not necessarily, well, let me put it another way. They're alienated from reality. They're merged in other realities and other ways of seeing things and other perceptions. And I think a lot of times they're always thinking, they're always entering into imaginative landscapes, and that's kind of where they spend their time. And if they're alienated, it's mostly because of the way they see the world and what they notice, and how what they notice kind of leads them to other parts of their imagination and other landscapes that may not necessarily be material.
And in Mujeres Matadas, I really thought that story was about community. And in the end, when I'll read this because it's really beautiful the way you end the story. As the crowd whistled and yelled for them to play another song, as the motion around them blurred into a dull colored background, the women looked at each other, the light in their eyes holding them together like a star.
Mujeres Matadas is a story about, it takes place during the height of the drug wars in Juarez, and it's a story about underground death metal scene there, and there's this all-girl band that comes out in the end. They're a black metal band, and black metal is even darker than death metal. The name of their band is Mujeres Matadas, the murdered women, and they come out and they dress like schoolgirls, like in a schoolgirl outfit with blood on it, but not to be sexy, but to show how the violence has affected women. Or they'll come out in a work smock, like somebody might wear at the maquiladora, and they'll have death makeup on and stuff like that.
How did you come up with that idea? Or was there such a band?
You know, I don't know how I came up with it. All I know is that it somehow just seemed... I kind of like going to death metal shows in El Paso, you know, and I like the energy, you know, mm-hmm. not too much of it because it can get rather dark, but most of it is very innocent gore. And and I remember seeing some clubs, some shows advertised in Juarez of death metal and black metal, and this was during the height of the drug wars, and my imagination just took off from there, and I created that story.
I really like the way you put in how mothers put pictures mm-hmm. of their murdered and or disappeared daughters
right.
as a part of like the thing, and it's really understated, but it's there as a real background. Because it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. Those pictures are ubiquitous, or right. they were. I don't know about now.
The last time I went into Juarez, I think it was actually to go to the Kentucky Club to hang out with you and some of our friends. And I do remember seeing some of those. And I do, you know, we look at the drug wars and we notice how many people are being killed. We notice all the mass murders. They're going inside of drug rehabilitation centers and mowing down people. And killing 20, 30 people. I mean, we hear a lot about that. But what's also happening in Juarez is the femicides have not stopped. There are young girls disappearing every day, and there are women being murdered and being raped. And
I hear they're up again.
Yeah, I think it's fundamental that if you're going to look at Juarez as a dangerous landscape or as a war zone, that the spirit of the women who are disappearing and who have died and who are suffering, you know, it's going to be there. It's that feminine presence of death and, you know, that horror is going to be there somehow. It's got to be.
I really appreciate how you don't exploit it. It's just part of the landscape right. and you don't sensationalize it. And in the last section, Hotel Juarez, I really like that it ends there, and I'll tell you why. I don't know what you were thinking, and maybe we can talk about the order of it, mm-hmm. because it also ends with drug use. Mm-hmm. But it's so kind of understated, because I wrote about it in my book, and it's like
right.
over the top.
It's chasing the dragon.
Just like. But you handled this. I guess I looked at it this way, that instead of talking about the drug wars per se, you talked about there is a market for drugs. And that's why there is the drug war. And you brought the story down into very, really kind of an intimate level. Mm-hmm. And you didn't sensationalize about it. And you didn't dramatize it. Not really. Mm-hmm. In fact, I want to ask you a question about that. You don't dramatize when you write. And yet you really evoke a lot of emotions. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you how you do that. Because I can't do that.
I guess to put it one way, I think of the Stanislavski method of acting. Stanislavski teaches an actor never to go on stage without a motivation beyond just the lines and beyond the direction.
Right.
And so if an actor is going on stage to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in the midst of his wife on the phone talking to her best friend, Stanislavski will say, okay, why are you going in there? If the actor says, I'm going in there to make a peanut butter sandwich, and, you know, Stanislavski will say, no, why are you going in there? And then until they admit that they're going in there because they want to overhear what their wife is saying on the phone because they think she's cheating. And even if this is not part of the script, if an actor goes on stage thinking that, every movement, even the way the actor picks up the knife and sticks it into the peanut butter, is betraying their inner desires and their inner life and that turmoil that's deep, 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 deep in there. And I think that what I try to do is I try to have characters whose every movement, even eating a cup of corn, is really, he's not really eating a cup of corn. He's looking for drugs. He's not really, you know, looking into a shop window at men tearing meat off the carcass of a chicken. He's looking for drugs. He's looking for that. And so I think maybe that's kind of, there is no gesture, there is no observation where there's not a motivation or there's not somehow a conduit to the gut and the desire of the character, and maybe even the gut and the desire of the writer, you know, that there should be somehow there's multiple things going on with every gesture.
There's no desperation in your book. And I like that. I'll tell you why I like that. Uh-huh. Because I live on the border. Uh-huh. And I think that people see us and they see the border as a desperate place. Mm-hmm. You know, and that people are desperate. Right. And there seems to be desire, mm-hmm. which is, I think, a good thing. And the desire is sexual, but it's also just a desire for some kind of ordinary, I want to say belonging. I think your characters are kind of comfortable in searching, mm-hmm. in the search. Fill mm-hmm. in the blank.
Yeah, well, you may be looking at some of the characters and some of the details and following the conduit all the way to Daniel Chacon because, you know, my life has been one of inquietud often, you know, and of restlessness and of, you know, needing to move on. And even though that certain times of my life, that may have been my weakness, it's also my strength. And I'm at a point in my life now where I still travel. You know, I still search. I still, you know, probe. I still follow language in such a way that it takes me to places that I'm discovering things. But I'm happy with the search. It's not it's not inquietude anymore. Now it's just inquiry into life.
And it's in here.
Yeah,
and
my inquiry into being.
Yeah, and it's in here. The two Juarez sections, one of them is Juarez is Burning, uh-huh. and the other is the Hotel Juarez. Mm-hmm. If I'd have written the book, my last chapter would have been Juarez is Burning. Mm-hmm. And yours is the Hotel Juarez. Mm-hmm. It implies this, the title, that you don't live there, mm-hmm. but you stay there mm-hmm. sometimes. You have a professor who's from the United States in that
probably
section.
Teaches at UTEP, imagine.
And he goes there. I know that you saw the Hotel Juarez, mm-hmm. and it symbolized the drug war. Mm-hmm. And you have a wonderful picture of it. It's your photograph on the cover. But Hotel conjures something. What does it conjure for you as a writer?
For me, the hotel is the shape of the book. And I think this book has been taking shape without me for many years and many drafts. And I think I finally caught up with it when I passed by that hotel and I took that picture. And I realized that the way the book, I think, wants to be shaped like is almost like an Escher house. There's multiple rooms and there's multiple hallways and staircases and there's windows and there's doors, but it's a place of the imagination. And as such, it's not subject to material laws. It's not subject to logic. It's not subject to anything linear. And so you can walk up a staircase going up and up and find yourself on the bottom floor again, or you could go through a hallway and see somebody approaching the opposite direction and you realize it's an earlier version of yourself. And I think that for me, the entire book is shaped like that hotel. And so ending it with that, it's all as if everything is emanating from inside room 322 where that professor is smoking crack.
Right.
Everything emanates from there.
Right. I'm going to end the interview by quoting a little bit of the book review that appeared in Booklist. Okay. And They called you a master of narrative brevity. Chacon collects several short fictions from standalone cones to connected vignettes under the app subtitle Stories, Rooms, and Loops. They go on to call it Reflective Labyrinths, and they also compare you to Bolaño. And I think that's really interesting because I know that Borges has been a big influence on your writing and your life. How does it feel to be compared to Borges?
Well, when I follow language into a story, I create, the language creates, I just kind of following along, the language kind of creates, I'm like the conduit, the language creates a landscape, and that landscape often might be mistaken for irreality or for Kabbalistic or for putting the principles of quantum mechanics into a material visible reality where phenomenon happens that is beyond our understanding or anti-intuitive. And I think anytime you create a landscape like that, you're going to find Borges there. And I think you're going to find a lot of other writers there too, right? Because a lot of writers hang out, and a lot of non-writers hang out, a lot of dreamers, a lot of seven-year-old girls hang out in realities like that. And so I think the comparison really has more to do with the way the reality is presented than anything else. And, you know, and if somebody wants to use Chacon and Borges in the same sentence, I'm completely open to their right to do that.
I want to end the show by saying that this book has received one starred review and one, I don't know why this one isn't starred, because it's a beautiful in book list, but it was a starred review in Publishers Weekly, and Alan Chews really loved your book on National Public Radio. Yeah. So we expect big things from this book.
Well, it's doing pretty well. I'm pretty happy with it, and I can't wait to share it with people. I'm going to start a book tour in the fall, and I'll be touring all over California and Texas and who knows where else.
Well, we've been talking to Daniel Chacon, who is not only just a co-host of Words on a Wire, but a real writer.
And you are too, Ben. And you know what? The next book that you and I write
may save our lives.
Yeah.